My guest is Gary Giddens, one of America's foremost jazz critics. He's written for the Village Voice since 1973. In his writing, he's bemoaned the fact that big band music has been in large measure shunted to university campuses and student orchestras. He said that we need a big band music that keeps its eye on the future while celebrating its past. Now, instead of just writing about that need, Giddens is trying to fill it. He's co-founded the American Jazz Orchestra and serves as its artistic director. The orchestra interprets classic jazz compositions and commissions new works. This Thursday, the orchestra will perform compositions by Duke Ellington in a concert at Cooper Union in Manhattan. But more about that in a little while. In Giddens' first book, he wrote that there were three themes asserted repeatedly in the lives of jazz musicians who came of age in the 1930s and 40s. The impact of Charlie Parker, the devastating post-war presence of heroin, and the difficulties of surviving without compromising one's music. He zeroes in on those themes in his biography of Charlie Parker titled Celebrating Bird. It's just been published in paperback. This is Charlie Parker's 1945 recording of Coco, which Giddens describes as thrilling. Gary Giddens, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Let me ask you, for our listeners who aren't familiar with Charlie Parker's music, to explain his musical importance.
Charlie Parker is one of those comet-like figures who come, it seems, exactly at the crisis point or midlife crisis point in an art when it needs really profoundly new ideas and directions. And Parker provided them. Jazz in the early and middle 1940s was coming down from the big band high. During the war, the big band era really kind of died and was replaced by singers and pop-type bands. And the solo styles of the 20s and 30s, just about everything you could play on them, had been done. And along comes Charlie Parker, an autodidactic virtuoso musician from Kansas City, and a few other colleagues who are thinking the way he thinks. And he revises the whole-scale notions of harmony, rhythm, and consequently the melodies that you make out of those harmonies and rhythms. And so he gave jazz a whole new life. And really, for the last 40 years, notwithstanding all the other revolutions that have come along, like the so-called new thing and the avant-garde, really the last 45 years have been pretty much jazz has been a music that proceeds from Charlie Parker as much as all of the jazz before him proceeds from Louis Armstrong.
Within the world of jazz, he's a figure who's been much written about. Is it a difficult task to write about someone who's been so thoroughly discussed and researched?
Not at all. I regret to say that so many of the musicians... Well, let me begin by saying that although the jazz literature comprises a great many extraordinary books in many fields, there are certain areas that jazz literature is sorely lacking in, and I think most particularly biography. I don't know of one jazz biography that you'd seriously compare with the great literary biographies or biographies of artists in other areas. And frequently the scholarship is quite shoddy, and the thing that shocked me when I started researching Parker is that when I went back to the previous books, there were errors on every page, but basic errors, dates, names, places, Charlie Parker being written about in cities that he couldn't possibly have been in. And then the keystone of my research was interviews with his first wife, a woman who knew Parker from the time he was 15, earlier actually, from the time he was a boy, and who married him when they were both, I think, 16 or 17. And she had never been interviewed by any Parker biographer, so she gave me a whole new insight into the Kansas City period and his growing up.
Yeah, what do you think are some of the new insights that she gave you into Parker's life?
Let's see. Well, I guess the place, one logical place to begin with is the narcotics. Parker used to like to boast that he was taking heroin from the time he was 12. Rebecca points out that that was impossible. And she tends, although this is somewhat based on her circumstantial observations, she seems to think that Parker's serious encounters with drugs were direct. There's a direct correlation between them and this accident that he had. He was involved in a car accident in 1937, I believe it was, when he broke several ribs, and another musician in the car was killed, and another one was hospitalized for several weeks. And Parker recuperated for a period of 2 months upstairs, and his home was in tremendous pain. And about that time, she remembers him, strangers traipsing up the stairs with pills and drugs and the other thing. She also points out that numerous little incidents and facts simply were not part of Parker lore before. For example, the fact that Duke Ellington invited him to join the band in 1939, and he refused and instead went with Jay McShann. Talking to various musicians who knew Parker back in that period, you begin to learn how assiduously he studied. From a musical point of view, the thing that fascinated me that has never been, there's never appeared in any commentary, critical or biographical, about Parker, and is now becoming cliche since the book came out a year ago, is the fact that one of his major influences was Chew Berry. Now, when I grew up reading about Parker, and in every book, they always talk about Lester Young and Buster Smith, and Lester Young and Lester Young, and how he memorized all the solos, and that's where he comes from. And in fact, he was just as influenced by the so-called the Coleman Hawkins Rococo virtuoso style of saxophone playing. And Rebecca says that the great breakthrough for him in his music was when Fletcher Henderson's 1936 recording of Steel and Apples came out, which has a chorus-long solo by Chew Berry. She said he played that record religiously, repeatedly, memorized the solo, played it on saxophone and piano. So here you have a whole new lineage added to the development of Parker's music.
Jazz critic Gary Giddens is my guest, and he's the author of a book called Celebrating Bird and the associate producer of a film also called Celebrating Bird that includes a lot of documentary footage of Parker performances. Gary Giddens is also the artistic director of the American Jazz Orchestra, a subject we'll discuss a little bit later. You know, in writing about someone like Parker, you're going to meet dozens and dozens of people who tell you, like, the pivotal story in their life about how Parker affected them or what Parker said to them. There's so many probably apocryphal stories that circulate about Parker. Were there any stories that you particularly wanted to research and see if they were really true or not?
Yes. you hit a kind of a sore point, because one of the I was held up in a tremendous snafu for several months in an attempt to research Parker's death, and I won't go into detail, but I interviewed numerous people, spoke to lawyers, made many attempts to look at the death certificate and various other records which are kept private, most of which I could never get my hands on. And there's no question in my mind that there is still some mystery about about his death, when it took place, all of the contributing factors. I don't know what the answer to that mystery is. All I know is that there are many, many rumors, all of which contradict each other. And I don't know that anyone will ever know the truth, because there were only two witnesses and they ain't talking. But for your listeners who don't have no idea what I'm talking about, let me just say briefly that Parker died, and nobody knew about it for 2 or 3 days. He died in the home of Baroness Koningswater, who's living at the Stanhope Hotel. And there was a rumor going around the city, on New York City, on that weekend that Parker had died. Murray Kempton and Bill Dufty, who were reporters at the New York Post at that time, called on a hunch the Bellevue, the morgue, and they were told no, there was no Charlie Parker, there was only a John Parker. And a black male, dead, listed at 53 years of age. And it turns out that for some reason Parker had been delivered there under that name. And later the Baroness said that she had not told anybody about the fact that Parker had died, because she didn't want the widow Chan to learn about it in the paper, she wanted to contact her first. But as I say, I can't even get into the specifics of the rumors because they might be slandering. They would be perhaps slandering people. But there are stories that people have saw Parker around that day, the day that he supposedly died. The fact that the body was in the apartment for some 3 or 4 hours before it was, between the time when it was declared dead by the medical examiner and when it arrived at Bellevue, and those hours had never been, I think, explained. And there were other factors here. So it's. It's a mystery. Parker was only 34 years old when he died, and yet the medical examiner estimated him as being a black male in his late 50s or early 60s.
And that was largely because of the ravages of heroin.
Indeed, and of alcohol.
You know, something that's really interesting is that Parker recorded some wonderful sessions with strings. Now, the kind of string arrangements that back him up are really kitschy stuff. I mean, you'd think that someone with his jazz brilliance would resist strings, but you talk about how he loved it and how he felt that he was really given his due when he was playing with strings.
Well, yes and no. I also talk about the fact that he did want to work with George Russell, for example. He commissioned George Russell to write the theme for strings, and had he lived and had he had more, had he been more in control, and you know, I mean, psychically as well as everything else, I think that there would have been, you would have seen him recording with arrangements by people like George Russell. Gil Evans he did use on one session with Singers, but he never had him write for the string ensemble. The fact is that it was an expensive and experimental thing to put together a string ensemble. Norman Granz financed it and brought in two California hack arrangements who had been writing for the big bands, and they wrote those, as you say, kitschy arrangements. Some of them are quite terrible, but then you see that, for example, Easy to Love, Parker on his own commissioned Jimmy Mundy to write a wonderful arrangement of that, which he later recorded and performed almost exclusively live. Jerry Mulligan write a few very good arrangements for the strings as well.
I want to play a minute of the Parker and Strings recording of Just Friends. What do you think of this recording?
Well, Just Friends is unquestionably the best of the Strings records, not because the arrangement is so wonderful, but because Parker's solo is superb.
Okay, let's give it a listen.
All right.
Charlie Parker and Strings, Just Friends, is recorded in 1949. My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. Gary, Parker was really a very self-destructive personality and used a lot of heroin, and a lot of musicians in emulating Parker's music started shooting up as well. Any insights you'd like to offer about how he became such a self-destructive figure, or you know why he was so self-destructive? It's a theme in a way that runs through the arts and certainly runs through part of jazz.
Yes, it's difficult to know. I think one thing that we have to say at the outset is that when Parker started using drugs in the 1930s, there was none of the awareness about drugs that we have now. Let's begin by noting that marijuana, for example, was legal in the United States until 1936. So growing up in an environment where marijuana was readily available was not a lot more dramatic than kids who grow up today drinking beer. It was there. It was legal. It grew near the railroad tracks outside of town. And heroin, it was Parker's generation of musicians, and not just musicians, but people in every walk of life, who discovered just how deadly a drug heroin was. Some of them who got hooked didn't quite believe that they could get hooked or that they wouldn't be able to free themselves. And because Parker was such a charismatic figure, so dramatically original in every way, and had such an extraordinary personality, everybody I interviewed virtually said that They couldn't believe that he was only 25 or 26 when they met him. He always seemed like everyone's father, like everyone's guide and leader. So naturally, many of these younger musicians thought that, well, maybe the heroine is in some way tied up with his genius. When in fact, as Parker noted repeatedly in interview after interview and in private conversations with, again, virtually every musician I spoke with, he denied that vehemently. He said that anyone who says that you play better high is just a plain, straight-out liar. And in fact, many of Parker's greatest records were made in the year that he cut himself loose from heroin, 1947.
Gary, one last question about Parker. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that Clint Eastwood is directing a movie about Charlie Parker. Have you heard anything about it? What are your expectations of this movie?
Well, interesting you should ask that, because I'm will soon be on my way out to interview him.
To interview Eastwood?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I was pleased to learn that he had seen my film and liked it.
Really?
He apparently, from what I'm told, has a very serious love for Parker and the music. You know, Eastwood is a very cagey and clever filmmaker. Every once in a while, he does a film strictly for himself that he knows isn't going to make money. Honky Tonk Man was a picture he did about country music a few years ago. And he finances them by returning to his hole card, which is the Dirty Harry series. Apparently, he told Warners that if they let him do this, he would give them another Dirty Harry, which he is now filming in San Francisco, and which will actually come out 2 or 3 months before the Parker film. From what I've heard from various people who have seen the script, they say it's a very romantic Hollywoodization in which Parker is depicted primarily in his involvement only with Chan, as though this were the one woman in his life. And Red Rodney is a major character, and Dizzy Gillespie is not there. So what I'm saying is that it appears to be that this is a lot of the usual Hollywood liberties are taken. On the other hand, I'm also told that Eastwood managed to evoke the era quite well. And so I'm going with an open mind. I'm hoping it'll be wonderful. I'm hoping it'll at the very least spread the word about Parker, and that more people will know about him. This is a monumental figure in our music, and most people have never even heard the name, let alone the music. So I can only be at this point optimistic about this film.
My guest is jazz critic Gary Giddens. He writes for The Village Voice, is the author of several books, including his latest, which is called Celebrating Bird, a biography of Charlie Parker. And he's also done a home video on Charlie Parker that's also a biography with a lot of footage from the period. In a moment, we're going to talk about Gary Giddens' new project, which is the American Jazz Orchestra, a repertory jazz orchestra, and we'll be hearing some of their music, talking about their work, after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Gary Giddens is my guest, and this week, March 3rd, his American Jazz Orchestra will be performing at Cooper Union in New York City. Gary, you put together this American Jazz Orchestra. You're the artistic director of it. What's your vision of the band?
Very simply, the original idea was to create a parallel to the Philharmonic Orchestras, which are in every cultural center of the United States, that play the 19th century European repertoire. Jazz is almost 100 years old. There's about 60 years body of work of music written for this uniquely American ensemble of 18 pieces consisting of reeds, brasses, and rhythm. And the music needs orchestras to play it, to keep it alive. This music was not conceived of for records. The recorded performances that we venerate are, except in very rare cases, not definitive performances. They're rather arbitrary performances done within the limitations of a 3:78. And we believe that the music has its own validity in the scores, not just in the record. We don't begin with a record, and we don't try to recreate or imitate the record. We go back to the score, to the written arrangements of people like Fletcher Henderson and Eddie Sauter and Gil Evans and Duke Ellington and Jimmy Mundy and Ralph Burns and many, many others, and we want to bring them alive. We think that this music is great and that people should hear it. Most people have never heard it in a concert hall, and it's a completely different experience.
Well, you make a very compelling point in one of your books. You say that imagine what it would be like if classical music were only performed by chamber ensembles and if there were no orchestras anymore. That's what it's like in jazz now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to play an excerpt of the American Jazz Orchestra recording of Benny Carter compositions. And this is recorded. Was this recorded in concert?
No, this was
recorded
was done
in the studio.
The next
right,
day,
right.
The very next day.
Okay. Well, we're going to hear part of Carter's composition, Symphony and Riffs. Tell me briefly why you wanted to have a new recording and a new performance of this piece.
So many reasons. First of all, as Carter pointed out, a lot of the early records were done with virtually no rehearsal in the studio. He wasn't satisfied with the original performances. They're done in lo-fi, according to the recording techniques of the 1930s. As John Lewis boasts frequently, very few band leaders in history have ever had a brass section that can rival the one that we've put together, because it's an all-star group. The best studio guys in New York come together four or five times a year to make this music. So it's a crack orchestra, and it's a chance to reinterpret the music and to show that Benny Carter as a soloist is as great at the age of 80 as he was at 30 when he put the alto saxophone on the map.
Okay, well, let's hear the opening of Symphony in Riffs. That's Symphony in Riffs from the new American Jazz Orchestra recording of Benny Carter compositions. My guest, jazz critic Gary Giddens, is the artistic director and founder of the American Jazz Orchestra. This is really a new role for you. You've been a jazz critic all of your adult life, but now you're actually working with musicians, collaborating with them on music. It's interesting to me, because when you're a critic, you're really worrying about the final product, the performance itself. But when you're working with an orchestra, things like promptness, you know,
right.
someone's ability
right.
to show up on time enters yeah. into it. Do you find yourself having a totally different relationship with the music and the musicians now?
I don't know that my relationship. Yes, it's become, I would say, certainly more intimate. You know where the relationship has really changed? It's in my writing. I find I know so much now from the other side that I didn't know then.
What kinds of things?
Oh, the so many things that go into making a big band. Uh-huh. Most of us who write about this music are obsessed with soloists. We don't know what a lead player does. We don't know what goes into making a section work, or balancing one section against another, or all the details that go into making an arrangement really exciting, or all the possibilities that a conductor has in interpreting that arrangement, and the way tempos, adjusting tempos, can completely change the meaning of a performance. And it's been enormously exciting and educational experience to watch the rehearsals, to see the way the music comes into being, and really to have a much closer look at the arrangements and the way they're put together. One of the things, Terry, that I wanted to mention in relationship to this whole idea of jazz repertory in the orchestra is the idea of interpretation. A lot of people, when they write about it, they talk about recreating the old pieces, and that word irks me. We're not recreating anything any more than Zubin Mehta is recreating, you know, Beethoven when he plays his symphonies. In classical music, interpretation is so much a part of performance that they take for granted. One of the most controversial and exciting records that's come out this year is Bernstein's new version of the Tchaikovsky Pathétique, which is about 10 or 12 minutes longer than any other version ever done. It's so slow that the articulation of the various sections is changed, and the piece is really made to come alive in a new way. It's really a thrilling thing. If we take a classic performance that people know from records and we slow it up or fast it, make it a little faster, we have people saying, well, the tempo was too slow, or it wasn't that fast on the record. Well, that's not the point. The point is you have scores, and then you have interpreters, you have conductors. John Lewis is going to conduct it differently than Frank Foster or the late Thad Jones or Maurice Paris or anyone else. That's what interpretation is about. And the dream that we had when we started this, I mean, this is a dream, is not that the American Jazz Orchestra would somehow change the way we hear the music, but that it would help to create repertory orchestras that would proliferate all over the country. And so that you'd have that interpretation would become a natural part of the experience of listening to this music.
Do you see your work with the American Jazz Orchestra as being in conflict with your work as a jazz critic or as an extension of it?
Both. There is a conflict. I tried to deny that for a while, thinking that somehow I had an objective thing about it, but I'm not objective at all. When I sit there on the night of a concert, I don't hear anything but wonderful sounds, and it's only a week later when I start playing the tapes, because we always make reference tapes, that I hear all the clams and mistakes. I don't hear them that night. I really don't. And so, no, I'm not at all objective, and it's very difficult for me. You know, I've learned a lot. My own ideas about interpretation, which I've been writing about in The Voice since 1973, have been a lot more focused by this experience, and I'd like to write about it. And it's difficult because at this point, how can I write about what I've learned about interpretation from the AJO without being self-serving? So that's difficult. But because I have learned a lot more about the way the music is made, there's no question that it's expanded my ideas about music, and I've learned a lot more about what musicians do.
Well, Gary, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And my guest has been Gary Giddens. He's the jazz critic for The Village Voice and the author of several books about jazz, including his latest, Celebrating Bird, The Triumph of Charlie Parker, which has just been published in paperback by William Morrow. There's also a home video of the same name. Giddens is the founder and artistic director of the American Jazz Orchestra. They'll perform in New York on March 3rd in a concert of Ellington compositions, including a performance of Black, Brown, and Beige. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.